curious passersby often ask me, just what is this truth jihad thing anyway? Well, everybody knows what truth is, but jihad is a misunderstood term. Jihad means effort or struggle. The greater jihad is the struggle to be a better person, while the lesser jihad is the struggle to defend the community. Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, did say that the best jihad is a word of truth flung in the face of a tyrant. And that's what we do here at Truth Jihad Radio! Every Friday, 8 to 10, 5 to 7 Pacific, right here on Revolution Radio!
I will defend myself against their tyranny. Number 3 is my radio broadcast. I'm squarely in front of the public all the time, and they all know what's going on.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
Hello, my name is John Wayne. And I do a broadcast here at freedomslips.com, revolution.radio, called The Unequivocal Truth on One.
Freedom and fear are at war.
And folks, I assure you, we are in defense condition one, as we journey perilously through this paradigm that we currently reside in. And I ask that you join me every Saturday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for the Unequivocal Truth, DEFCON 1.
We shall never surrender.
Life's like poetry, but in my poem, babe, until now, always been a missing line. You know life's too short to hide a good thing you feel. And I find the morning after is the best time to determine if it's real. Baby, finding you gave my whole world reason to rhyme. But life's like poetry, and in my poem, babe, until now, there's always been a missing line. Life's too short to think about right or wrong. And the only thing I wonder about is where you've been so long. Until now, there's always been a missing line. La da dee da da. Oh, up till now, there's always been a missing line.
Hey. Hey, good afternoon. Well, good morning. Well, hang on. What time is it? Yeah, good. No, it's good afternoon, isn't it? Sorry, I was just so wrapped up in Dolly there that I completely lost track of where I was. Good start to the show, isn't it? Anyway, good afternoon and good evening from a beautiful United Kingdom, folks. This is Saturday the 17th of September 2022 edition of Willow's Poetry Corner, which is, my name's Willow, by the way, Andreas, and also known as Sorry Sunflower in the Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com chat room. And, yep, oh, thank you, Fleece. Yep, Fleece is posting up some details about today's focus here in the Poetry Corner. I'll get to that in a minute. Thank you very much, Fleece. He's a sweetheart, gentleman. Yay. Yeah, it's just turned 7 o'clock in the evening over here in the UK. And this is a bit more of a relaxed show than the Sunday and the weekday shows. I just tend to go off track sometimes, which I do in the usual show anyway. But yeah, I hope you're all having a good good Saturday wherever you are in the world. If you're down under, it's Sunday morning now, isn't it? But before I get started with talking about who today's focus is going to be, just want to remind you that you're listening to this weird old show of mine on the world's largest listener supported station, folks. We are Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And if you'd like to help us out, you're not sure how, what I recommend you do is you visit our website, which you can reach using either www.revolution.radio or www.freedomslips.com. Or take you to the exact same location. You'll arrive upon our website, and the places you need to explore to be found in the nav bar, which is the donations option. Go in there, explore. There's different ways you can help the station. You can advertise on the station's website as well for $25 a month. If you'd like further details, just let us know. We've got dedicated call to listen numbers for both studios, not for the Nest at the moment. We've got dedicated call to listen numbers for both Studio A and B. Our costs involved in calling those, but if you want to check out those numbers, they're on the website. And also we've got the archives for free as well. You can access them using the link in the nav bar, or you can just go direct to its URL, which is www.revolutionradioarchives.com, and it details in full how you can get in there. And this person once completely forgot to include part of it, and she didn't get in. She's a troglodyte, you see. Not a Luddite. Luddites, I've spoken about the Luddites before. Luddites weren't actually against technology. They were against what abuse of that technology, as opposed to anything else. I did a show on a segment of a show on the Luddites once. Very interesting it was. But so it's going to be a far more relaxed show. And looking in the chat room, there's a lot of chat about serious stuff going on in there, and I'm not going to be serious today. Well, some of the poetry might be serious, but myself, no. No. And, let's see. Oh, Lizzie's in there. Oh, Lizzie's in the, she's in the Willow's Weird World section. Sending Lizzie some healing thoughts there because she's not feeling too bright today. I'm not going to mention why. She can tell you that about that herself tomorrow. Oh, joys are getting older. That's all I can say. So who's in the chat room? Let's see who's in. Dot Comet is in as well as the lovely Lizzie. Lizzie, of course, is one of our hosts. She hosts two shows here at the station. She's on tomorrow. Well, she's on Sundays, yeah. At 11 o'clock in the morning, 11 a.m. Eastern. Weird Spirit Talk with Lizzie. She's also on Studio A on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern with Coffee Time with Lizzie. Popsicle Toes is in as well. Yeah, where's that? Where's those details I asked you for, Popsicle Toes? No, she's not listening anyway. She never does. The fabulous manager that is Pat Rabbit is in the chat room. Of course, he is the host of Not For Public Consumption, which is on Studio B on Thursdays at midday Eastern. I'm going to go up to the top of the hour to see who else is in. Malaya is in as well as in the kitchen. Yes, I believe. That's a rogue clone. Shh, don't tell anyone. State secret and all that. Oh, yeah, she's mentioned in there what happened. Yeah, she fell down the stairs. So the joys are getting older. These things happen. Children fall down the stairs as well, so it's not exactly restricted to age, is it? I don't know about you, Lizzie, but when I've had similar falls in the past, the thing that's injured most is the pride, especially if it's right in front of everybody. That hurts more than the actual injury itself. It's the embarrassment of it. Gosh. I'm supposed to in the chat. Fleece has just posted in this. Did I read correctly? Yesterday, the police had to deal with someone who jumped on the coffin. There's a reference to, the queen lying in state. Yes, somebody did indeed go up, but they didn't jump onto the coffin. They touched it. Yeah, that's all they do, which is a no-no. I've been keying up with things because it is undeniably a very historic time over here right now. So I am keeping up with things, and I do recognise the very human aspect to all this, and that regardless of what folk think and feel about the royal family, they are humans nonetheless who have lost a loved one, and compassion should always be the first port of call in such circumstances. There'll be time for recriminations and cogitations afterwards, and believe me, there will be plenty of it. I know that. But anyway, there's enough of that today. So today's Poetry Corner is going to be focusing on a previous, excuse me, I'm just going to take a sip. I've had this mug of tea next to me. It's almost completely full for about 2 hours. And I've only taken two or three sips of it. I'm so used to drinking cold tea. Seriously, if I have a cup of hot tea, what is this? What is this here? I'm used to iced tea. Huh? There we go. That's a bit better. But anyway, where was I? Yes, the poetry corner. Yes, but the today's focus is going to be a poet I've studied before on the weekday segment of the Poetry Corner. Indeed, back in, I think it was September 2020. And because I'm revisiting some old favourites, and Elizabeth Bishop is one of these. And as I said, the beauty of this show and the flexibility of it is that I can devote more time to the poet's works as opposed to the poet themselves. Although I will, as those have tuned in to listen, know that I do actually read out a study first, which gives you an idea of where the poet comes from, their inspirations, and what led them to writing poetry in the first place. Again, Sylvia Plath has been on here already, but I'll more than likely be revisiting her. I know that because she is just such, I'd say she's probably one of the most fascinating poets of all. But she's not today. It's Elizabeth Bishop. And Elizabeth Bishop was probably one of 20th century American poetry's most understated yet powerfully personally nuanced of writers, really. She was a consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress in 1949-1950. She was a winner of a 1956 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, a woman who the New York Times critic Dwight Garner acclaimed as being the most purely gifted poet of the 20th century. And it's interesting how many poets, she was born in Massachusetts, and it's interesting how many poets have been born in Massachusetts that I've covered so far. I do remember Patrick actually mentioning there was a reason for that in the chat room once, just why there are so many born in Massachusetts. You might care to repeat it, Patrick, so I can read it on air. But yeah, it's just fascinating. She's one of them. If I'm remembering, yes, I think so was Sylvia Plath. I think she was Massachusetts. Yeah, well, there's quite a few. But I'll do what I always do, which is I'll read the opening paragraph of a Wikipedia page. Indeed, the lovely Fleest has also shared some details up in the chat room as well, which I may as well read out because it's probably the same thing. Let's go back up to see where it is. Yep. Oh, here we go. Elizabeth Bishop. She was born on February 8th, 1911. She died on October 6th, 1979. She was an American poet and short story writer. She was a consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress from 1949 to 1950. The Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry in 1956. The National Book Award winner in 1970. the year of yours truly's birth here, and the recipient of a Newsstat International Prize for Literature in 1976. Yep, Dwight Garner argued that she was perhaps the most purely gifted poet of the 20th century. So yeah, it's the exact same thing, isn't it? From Wikipedia. Yep. So I don't need to share that up in here, but I will be reading the My Poetic Side, and it's a very brief, fairly brief bio of Elizabeth Bishop before we actually focus on her poetry itself, which I think, do you know what I'm going to do as well, because there's not an awful lot about her in this bio. I'm going to, as I say, this is where it's the more relaxed aspect of the show, really, isn't it? I just, let's have a look. Mind you, I do this in the other show as well, so I don't think it makes any difference, does it? I don't want to look at that one. Or is this one too long? I think I looked at this one, and whilst it's very, very detailed, and it is fabulous article on the New Yorker. It is it's too long for this particular purpose. So I will be looking at. I'll bring up the Poetry Foundation's one as well. So I'll read a couple of bios out. There's the My Poetic Side bio, I'll start with the Poetry Foundation's study of Elizabeth Bishop first, which is, she was born in 1911 in Worcester, Massachusetts, and grew up there and in Nova Scotia. Her father died before she was a year old, and her mother suffered seriously from mental illness. She was committed to an institution when Bishop was five. Raised first by her maternal grandparents in Nova Scotia, Bishop's wealthy paternal grandparents eventually brought her to live in Massachusetts. During her lifetime, Bishop was a respected yet somewhat obscure figure in the world of American literature. Since her death in 1979, however, her reputation has grown to the point that many critics, like Larry Rota in the New York Times, have referred to her as one of the most important American poets of the 20th century. Bishop was a perfectionist who did not write prolifically, preferring instead to spend long periods of time polishing her work. She published only 101 poems during her lifetime. Her verse is marked by precise descriptions of the physical world and an air of poetic serenity, but her underlying themes include the struggle to find a sense of belonging and the human experiences of grief and longing. She was educated at the elite Walnut Hills School for Girls and Vassar College. Her years at Vassar were tremendously important to Bishop. There she met Marianne Moore, a fellow poet who became a lifelong friend. Working with a group of students that included Mary McCarthy, Eleanor Clark, and Margaret Miller, she founded the short-lived but influential literary journal Conspirito, which was conceived as an alternative to the well-established Vassar Review. After graduating, Bishop lived in New York and travelled extensively in France, Spain, Ireland, Italy, and North Africa. Her poetry is filled with descriptions of her journeys and the sights that she saw. In 1938, she moved to Key West, where she wrote many of the poems that eventually were collected in her first volume, North and South, which was published in 1946. Her second poetry collection, Poems North and South and A Cold Spring from 1955, received the Pulitzer Prize. In 1944, she left Key West, and for 14 years she lived in Brazil with her lover, the architect Lotho de Macedo Soares, in Petropolis. After Soares took her own life in 1967, Bishop spent less time in Brazil than in New York, San Francisco, and Massachusetts, where she took a teaching position at Harvard in 1970. That same year, she received a National Book Award in Poetry for The Complete Poems. Her reputation increased greatly in the years just prior to her death, particularly after the 1976 publication of Geography 3 and her winning of the Newsstat International Prize for Literature. Bishop worked as a painter as well as a poet, and her verse, like visual art, is known for its ability to capture significant scenes. Though she was independently wealthy and thus enjoyed a life of some privilege, Much of her poetry celebrates working class settings, busy factories, farms and fishing villages. Analysing her small but significant body of work for Bold Type, Ernie Hilbert wrote, Bishop's poetics is one distinguished by tranquil observation, craft-like accuracy, care for the small things of the world, a miniaturist's discretion and attention. Unlike the Persian woolly poetry that came to dominate American literature by the second half of her life, her poems are balanced like Alexander Caudle Mobiles, turning so subtly so as to seem almost still at first, every element, every weight of meaning and song, poised flawlessly against the next. So, yeah, she was, again, another poet who really sort of came to prominence in the years following her passing. So it's just post these in the chat rooms. And yeah, I will have a look at the my poetic side bio as well, which there probably will be a little bit of repetition here, but it doesn't matter. So starts with an Elizabeth Bishop quote, which is, the art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. I'll repeat that. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Fascinating. Yeah. I have said very similar myself about various things, but anyway, carrying on. Esso cans. Cats named Minnow. Fish houses. All the detritus of everyday life. Scenes and items and even people destined for obsolescence. These are subjects that Elizabeth Bishop captured in her poetry. These things filled with the intent to be lost. Maybe Bishop herself was a little afraid of being lost. Born in Massachusetts in 1911, Elizabeth Bishop was raised by a succession of relatives after her father's death and her mother's hospitalisation. As a result of his shuffle from house to house, Bishop once commented that she evermore felt like a guest. Educated at Vassar, Bishop was all set to attend medical school when the Vassar librarian arranged a meeting between Bishop and poet Marianne Moore, a meeting that changed the course of Bishop's life. Medical school was out. Elizabeth Bishop, from then on, was a poet. Thankfully, Bishop did not need to work as a doctor to support herself. A sizable inheritance from her father left her independently wealthy, and therefore financially able to dedicate herself to her poetry and to travel extensively. Her experiences and her travels throughout the world were reflected in her poetry. Bishop's poetry earned her some of the most coveted awards in the world of writing. Among the awards she received, excuse me, I'm just making myself comfortable. Ooh, that's not one of them. 1945, she received the Houghton Mifflin Poetry Prize Fellowship. 1947, the Guggenheim Fellowship. 1949, appointed consultant in poetry at the Library of Congress. 1950, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Award. 1953, Shelley Memorial Award. 1954, lifetime membership in the National Institute of Arts and Letters. 1956, Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. 1969, National Book Award. 1976, elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters. 1976, Books Abroad, Neustadt International Prize. 1977, National Book Critics Circle Award, and again, 1978, Guggenheim Fellowship. The final Guggenheim Fellowship was awarded after Elizabeth Ibb's death from an aneurysm in 1979. Perhaps one of the factors that contributed to the popularity of Bishop's poetry was its impersonality. Bishop wrote poems that most often detailed other people, places, or things. Rarely did she turn her pen inward and write of more personal experiences and feelings. However, Her witty, graceful verse captured even those experiences and people most unlike Bishop. Memorably, what on the earth is that supposed to say? Anyway, somebody needed to edit themselves there. An excellent, most unlike her. Okay, got it. An excellent example of Bishop's poetry is Filling Station, which I will read now. Oh, but it is dirty. This little filling station, oil-soaked, oil-permeated to a disturbing, all-over black translucency. Be careful with that match. Father wears a dirty, oil-soaked monkey suit that cuts him under the arms, and several quick and saucy and greasy sons assist him. It's a family filling station, all quite thoroughly dirty. Do they live in the station? It has a cement porch with humps, and on it a set of crushed and grease-impregnated wickerwork. On the wicker sofa, a dirty dog, quite comfy. Some comic books provide the only note of colour of certain colour. They lie upon a big, dim doily draping a tabaret, part of a set, beside a big hirsute begonia. Why the extraneous plant? Why the tabaret? Why, oh, why the doily? Embroidered in daisy stitch with marguerites, I think, and heavy with grey crochet. Somebody embroidered a doily. Somebody waters the plant, or oils it, maybe. Somebody arranges the rows of cans so that they softly say, so, to high-strung automobiles. Somebody loves us all. It's a scene familiar to all, but rarely the subject of poetry. Yet Bishop immortalises the grubby filling station, improbably accented by doilies and plants, with the benediction, somebody loves us all. Bishop captures another common but rarely celebrated experience in exchanging hats. And funny uncles who insist on trying on a lady's hat. Oh, even if the joke falls flat, we share your slight transvestite twist, in spite of our embarrassment. Costume and custom are comics. The headgear of the other sex inspires us to experiment. Anandrous aunts who, at the beach with paper plates upon your laps, keep putting on the yachtsman's caps with exhibitionistic screech. The visors hanging over the ear, so that the golden anchors drag. The tides of fashion never lag. Such caps may not be worn next year. Or you who don the paper plate itself and put some grapes upon it and will sport the Indian's feather bonnet. Perversities may aggravate the natural madness of the hatter. And if the opera hats collapse and crowns grow drafty, then perhaps he thinks what might a mitre matter. Unfunny uncle, you who wore a hat too big or one too many, tell us, can't you, are there any stars inside your black fedora? Aunt exemplary and slim, with a vernal eyes, we wonder what slow changes they see under their vast, shady, turned-down brim. Bishop takes a silly joke, trying on the other sex's hat, and makes it into an interesting question, into both human motive and desire. So, I'm now going to read a healthy selection of her poetry. And Oh, excuse me, if you can just hear me scratching my head there. The first poem we're going to start with is, I don't need to read Filling Stationer Exchanging Hats again. It's going to be A Miracle for Breakfast. So now the rest of the show is going to be dedicated to poetry. And if I read through all the poetry, then I'll find something else to talk about with regard to Elizabeth Bishop. At 6 o'clock, we were waiting for coffee. Waiting for coffee in the charitable crumb that was going to be served from a certain balcony, like kings of old, or like a miracle. It was still dark. 1 foot of a sun steadied itself on a long ripple in the river. The first ferry of the day had just crossed the river. It was so cold, we hoped that the coffee would be very hot, seeing that the sun was not going to warm us, and that the crumb would be a loaf each, buttered by a miracle. At 7, a man stepped out on the balcony. He stood for a minute alone on the balcony, looking over our heads toward the river. A servant handed him the makings of a miracle, consisting of one lone cup of coffee and one roll, which he proceeded to crumb, his head, so to speak, in the clouds, along with the sun. Was the man crazy? What under the sun was he trying to do up there on his balcony? Each man received one rather hard crumb, which some flicked scornfully into the river, and, in a cup, one drop of the coffee. Some of us stood around, waiting for the miracle. I can tell what I saw next. It was not a miracle. A beautiful villa stood in the sun. From its doors came the smell of hot coffee. In front, a baroque white plaster balcony added by birds who nest along the river. I saw it with one eye close to the crumb, galleries and marble chambers. My crumb, my mansion, made for me by a miracle, through ages, by insects, birds, and the river working the stone. Every day in the sun, at breakfast time, I sit on my balcony with my feet up and drink gallons of coffee. We lick up the crumb and swallow the coffee. A window across the river caught the sun as if the miracle were working on the wrong balcony. Next is A Prodigal. I love her writing. Oh, it's abslanguid. I love it. The brown, enormous odour he lived by was too close with its breathing and thick hair for him to judge. The floor was rotten. The sty was plastered halfway up with glass-smooth dung. Light-lashed, self-righteous, above-moving snouts. The pig's eyes followed him, a cheerful stare. Even to the sow that always ate her young, till, sickening, he leaned to scratch her head. But sometimes, mornings after drinking bouts, he hid the pints behind the 2x4s, the sunrise glazed the barnyard mud with red. The burning puddles seemed to reassure. And then he thought he might endure his exile yet another year or more. But evenings, the first star came to warn. The farmer whom he worked for came at dark to shut the cows and horses in the barn beneath their overhanging clouds of hay, with pitchforks, faint forked lightnings, catching light, safe and companionable as in the ark. The pigs stuck out their little feet and snored. The lantern, like the sun going away, laid on the mud a pale. Carrying a bucket along a slimy board, he felt the bat's uncertain staggering flight, his shuddering insights beyond his control touching him. But it took him a long time finally to make up his mind to go home. Oh, I love her writing. Oh, it's lovely. Next is Anaphora. Oh, excuse me. If you can hear any noises here, my head starts itching after a little while. Mind. It's not been too bad recently, but... Anaphora. Each day with so much ceremony begins, with birds, with bells, with whistles from a factory. Such white gold skies our eyes first open on, such brilliant walls that for a moment we wonder, where is the music coming from? The energy. The day was meant for what ineffable creature we just missed. Oh, promptly he appears and takes his earthly nature instantly falls victim of long intrigue, assuming memory and mortal fatigue. More slowly falling into sight and showering into stippled faces, darkening, condensing all his light. In spite of all the dreaming squandered upon him with that look, suffers our uses and abuses, sinks through the drift of bodies, sinks through the drift of glasses, to evening to the beggar in the park who, weary, without lamp or book, prepares stupendous studies. The fiery event of every day in endless, endless ascent. Oh, she's good, isn't she? Hello, Lady Horse is in. Yay! Terry's in. Host of A Touch of Country. One of the managers here at the station. She's the station's treasurer and moderator manager and a wonderful person. She's in. I love her writing. Marvellous. Next is Argument. Days that cannot bring you near or will not. Distance trying to appear something more obstinate. Argue with me endlessly, neither proving you less wanted nor less dear. Distance. Remember all that land beneath the plain. That coastline of dim beaches deep in sand, stretching indistinguishably all the way to where my reasons end. Days. And think of all those cluttered instruments, one to a fact, cancelling each other's experience. How they were like some hideous calendar, complements of never and forever ink. The intimidating sound of these voices we must separately find can and shall be vanquished. Days and distance disarrayed again and gone. Arrival at Santos. Next. Oh, I'm going to enjoy this one. I enjoy all of them, but some of them I just look at, I think, yeah, I'm going to like this one in particular. Here is a coast. Here is a harbour. Here, after a meagre diet of horizon, is some scenery. Impractically shaped and, who knows, self-pitying mountains, sad and harsh beneath their frivolous greenery, with a little church on top of one. And warehouses, some of them painted a feeble pink or blue, and some tall, uncertain palms. Oh, tourist, is this how this country is going to answer you and your immodest demands for a different world and a better life and complete comprehension of both at last and immediately after 18 days of suspension? Finish your breakfast. The tender is coming, a strange and ancient craft, flying a strange and brilliant rag. So that's the flag. I never saw it before. I somehow never thought of there being a flag, but of course there was, all along. And coins, I presume, and paper money. They remain to be seen. And gingerly now we climb down the ladder backward, myself and a fellow passenger named Miss Breen, descending into the midst of 26 freighters waiting to be loaded with green coffee bows. Please, boy, do be more careful with that boat hook. Watch out! Oh, it has caught Miss Breen's skirt. There. Miss Breen is about 70, a retired police lieutenant, 6 feet tall, with beautiful bright blue eyes and a kind expression. Her home, when she is at home, is in Glens Falls, New York. There. We're settled. The customs officials will speak English, we hope, and leave us our bourbon and cigarettes. Ports and necessities, like postage stamps or soap, but they seldom seem to care what impression they make, or, like this, only attempt, since it does not matter, the unassertive colours of soap or postage stamps. Wasting away, like the former, slipping away, the latter. The way the latter do when we mail the letters we wrote on the boat, either because the glue here is very inferior or because of the heat. We leave Santos at once. We are driving to the interior. Next is at the fish houses. Although it is a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses an old man sits netting. His net, in the gloaming, almost invisible, a dark purple-brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. The five fish houses have steeply peaked roofs and narrow, cleated gangplanks slant up to the storerooms and the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down on. All is silver. The heavy surface of the sea, swelling slowly as if considering spilling over, is opaque, but the silver of the benches, the lobster pots and musts, scattered among the wild, jagged rocks, is of an apparent translucence, like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. The big fish tubs are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy iridescent coats of mail, with small iridescent flies crawling on them. Up on the little slope behind the houses, set in a sparse bright sprinkle of grass, is an ancient wooden capstan, cracked with two long bleached handles and some melancholy stains like dried blood, where the ironwork has rusted. The old man accepts a lucky strike. He was a friend of my grandfather. We talk of the decline in the population and of codfish and herring while he waits for a herring boat to come in. There are sequins on his vest and on his thumb. Excuse me a minute, I've just got to mute a moment. Hold on. I'm back. He has scraped the scales, the principal beauty, from unnumbered fish with that black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away. Down at the water's edge, a place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp descending into the water, thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the grey stones, down and down at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal particularly I've seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music. Like me, a believer in total immersion, so I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I also sang A Mighty Fortress is Our God. He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge almost in the same spot with a sort of shrug as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear, grey, icy water. Back, behind us, the dignified tall firs begin. Bluish, associating with their shadows, a million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded grey and blue-grey stones. I've seen it over and over. The same sea, same, slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache, and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark grey flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be. Dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown. Oh, I like that one. I like that one. Next is Cape Breton. It's where I hope I get some pronunciations right. If I don't, please let me know. Oh, excuse me. So Cape Breton. Out on the high bird islands, Cibot and Hertford, or Hartford rather, the razorbill auks and the silly-looking puffins all stand with their backs to the mainland in solemn uneven lines along the cliff's brown grass-frayed edge, while the few sheep pastured there go, baa, baa. Sometimes, frightened by aeroplanes, they stampede and fall over into the sea or onto the rocks. The silken water is weaving and weaving, disappearing under the mist equally in all directions, lifted and penetrated now and then by one shag's dripping serpent neck. And somewhere the mist incorporates the pulse, rapid but unurgent, of a motorboat. The same mist hangs in thin layers among the valleys and gorges of the mainland like rotting snow I sucked away almost to spirit. The ghosts of glass drift among these folds and folds of fir. Spruce and hackmatack. Dull, dead, deep peacock colours each rider distinguished from the next by an irregular nervous sawtooth edge, alike but certain as a stereoscopic view. The wild road clambers along the brink of the coast. On it stand occasional bulldozers, but the day is Sunday. The little white churches have been dropped into the matted hills like lost quartz. The road appears to have been abandoned. Whatever the landscape had of meaning appears to have been abandoned, unless the road is holding it back in the interior where we cannot see, where deep lakes are reputed to be, and disused trails and mountains of rock and miles of burnt forests standing in grey scratches like the admirable scriptures made on stones by stones. And these regions now have little to say for themselves, except in thousands of light song sparrow songs floating upward freely, dispassionately, through the mist and meshing in brown, wet, fine, tall fishnets. A small bus comes along, in up and down rushes, packed with people even to its step. On weekdays with groceries, spare automobile parts and pump parts, but today only two preachers extra, one carrying his frock coat on a hanger. It passes a closed roadside stand, the closed schoolhouse, where today no flag is flying from the rough adzed pole topped with a white china doorknob. It stops, and a man carrying a bay gets off, climbs over a stile, and goes down through a small, steep meadow, which establishes his poverty in a snowfall of daisies, to his invisible house beside the water. The birds keep on singing. A calf bawls. The bus starts. The thin mist follows the white mutations of its dream. An ancient chill is rippling the dark brooks. Shadows. Chatter. Next is Casablanca. Oh, Casabianca, rather. Not Casablanca, Casabianca. Casabianca. It depends if she's in Italy here. Casabianca, that would be. I'm going to say Casabianca. Loves the boy stood on the burning deck trying to recite "The boy stood on the burning deck." Loves the sun stood stammering elocution while the poor ship in flames went down. Loves the obstinate boy, the ship, even the swimming sailors, who would like a schoolroom platform too, or an excuse to stay on deck. And loves the burning boy. There we go, I'll just share those. Next is Chemin de Fer. Alone on the railroad track, I walked with pounding heart. The tires were too close together, or maybe too far apart. The scenery was impoverished. Scrub pine and oak. Beyond its mingled grey-green foliage, I saw the little pond where the dirty old hermit lives, lie like an old tear holding on to its injuries lucidly year after year. The hermit shot off his shotgun and the tree by his cabin shook. Over the pond went a ripple. The pet hen went chook-chook. "Love should be put into action," screamed the old hermit. Across the pond, an echo tried and tried to confirm it. She's good, isn't she? I like her work. Excuse me, I've just got to blow my nose. Back. Next is Cirque du Bay. Why am I remembering? That's Divay is French for of winter. Circus of winter. If I remember my French correctly. Okay. Across the floor flits the mechanical toy, fit for a king of several centuries back. A little circus horse with real white hair. His eyes are glossy black. He bears a little dancer on his back. She stands upon her toes and turns and turns. A slanting spray of artificial roses is stitched across her skirt and tinsel bodice. Above her head, she poses another spray of artificial roses. His mane and tail are straight from Chirico. He has a formal, melancholy soul. He feels her pink toes dangle toward his back along the little pole that pierces both her body and her soul, and goes through his and reappears below, under his belly, as a big tin key. He canters three steps, then he makes a bow, canters again, bows on one knee, canters, then clicks and stops and looks at me. The dancer, by this time, has turned her back. He is the more intelligent by far. Facing each other rather desperately, his eye is like a star. We stare and say, well, we have come this far. Next is Conversation. The tumult in the heart keeps asking questions. And then it stops and undertakes to answer in the same tone of voice. No one could tell the difference. Uninnocent, these conversations start and then engage the senses, only half meaning to. And then there is no choice. And then there is no sense. Until a name and all its connotation are the same. Now, I've already read Exchanging Hats and Filling Station. So we're going to first Death in Nova Scotia. Interesting poem, given what's happening around what we're happening in the world right now. In the cold, cold parlour, my mother laid out Arthur beneath the chromographs. Edward, Prince of Wales, with Princess Alexandra, and King George with Queen Mary. Below them on the table stood a stuffed loon shot and stuffed by Uncle Arthur, Arthur's father. Since Uncle Arthur fired a bullet into him, he hadn't said a word. He kept his own counsel on his white frozen lake, the marble-topped table. His breast was deep and white, cold and caressable. His eyes were red glass, much to be desired. "Come," said my mother, "come and say goodbye to your little cousin Arthur." I was lifted up and given one lily of the valley to put in Arthur's hand. Arthur's coffin was like a little frosted cake, and the red-eyed loon eyed it from his white, frozen lake. Arthur was very small. He was all white, like a doll that hadn't been painted yet. Jack Frost had started to paint him the way he always painted the maple leaf, forever. He'd just begun on his hair, a few red strokes, And then Jack Frost had dropped the brush and left him white forever. The gracious royal couples were warm in red and ermine. Their feet were well wrapped up in the ladies' ermine trains. They invited Arthur to be the smallest page at court. But how could Arthur go, clutching his tiny lily, with his eyes shut up so tight and the roads deep in snow? Next is Five Flights Up. Still dark. The unknown bird sits on his usual branch. The little dog next door barks in his sleep inquiringly just once. Perhaps in his sleep, too, the bird inquires once or twice, quavering. Questions, if that is what they are, answered directly, simply, by day itself. Enormous morning, ponderous, meticulous. Grey light streaking each bare branch, each single twig along one side, making another tree of glassy veins. The bird still sits there. Now he seems to yawn. The little black dog runs in his yard. His owner's voice arises, stern. You ought to be ashamed. What has he done? He bounces cheerfully up and down. He rushes in circles in the fallen leaves. Obviously he has no sense of shame. He and the bird know everything is answered, all taken care of. No need to ask again. Yesterday brought to today so lightly. A yesterday I find almost impossible to lift. Next is Florida. Florida by Elizabeth. This is Elizabeth Bishop, by the way, if you're just tuning in, the poems. This is studying Elizabeth Bishop for the next 52 minutes. The state with the prettiest name, the state that floats in brackish water, held together by mangrove roots that bear while living oysters in clusters. And when dead strew white swamps with skeletons, dotted as if bombarded with green hummocks like cannonballs sprouting grass. The state full of long S-shaped birds, blue and white, and unseen hysterical birds who rush up the scale every time interim. Tanagers embarrassed by their flashiness, and pelicans whose delight it is to clown. Who coast for fun on the strong tidal currents in and out among the mangrove islands and stand on the sandbars drying their damp gold wings on sunlit evenings. Enormous turtles, helpless and mild, die and leave their barnacled shells on the beaches, and the large white skulls with round eye sockets twice the size of a man's. The palm trees clatter in the stiff breeze like the bills of the pelicans. The tropical rain comes down to freshen the tide-looped strings of fading shells. Job's tear, the Chinese alphabet, the scarce genonia, party-coloured pectins and ladies' ears arranged as on a grey rag of rotted calico, the buried Indian princess's skirt. With these, the monotonous, endless, sagging coastline is delicately ornamented. 30 or more buzzards are drifting down, 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 over something they have spotted in the swamp, in circles like stirred-up flakes of sediment sinking through water. Smoke from wood fires filters fine blue solvents. On stumps and dead trees the charring is like black velvet. the mosquitoes go hunting to the tune of their ferocious obligatos. After dark, the fireflies map the heavens in the marsh until the moon rises. Cold white, not bright, the moonlight is coarse-meshed, and the careless, corrupt state is all black specks too far apart and ugly whites. The poorest postcard of itself. After dark, the pools seem to have slipped away. The alligator, who has five distinct calls, friendliness, love, mating, war, and a warning, whimpers and speaks in the throat of the Indian princess. Next is Giant Snail. Okay. I love her descriptions of nature. Exquisite. Absolutely exquisite. The rain has stopped. The waterfall will roar like that all night. I've come out to take a walk and feed. My body, foot that is wet and cold and covered with sharp gravel. It is white, the size of a dinner plate. I've set myself a goal, a certain rock, but it may well be dawn before I get there. Although I move ghost-like and my floating edges barely graze the ground, I am heavy, heavy, heavy. My white muscles are already tired. I give the impression of mysterious ease, but it is only with the greatest effort of my will that I can rise above the smallest stones and sticks. And I must not let myself be distracted by those rough spears of grass. Don't touch them. Draw back. Withdrawal is always best. The rain has stopped. The waterfall makes such a noise. What if I fall over it? The mountains of black rock give off such clouds of steam. Shiny streamers are hanging down their sides. When this occurs, we have a saying that the snail gods have come down in haste. I could never descend such steep escarpments, much less dream of climbing them. That toad was big, too, like me. His eyes beseeched my love. Our proportions horrify our neighbours. Rest a minute. Relax. Flattened to the ground, my body is like a pallid decomposing leaf. What's that tapping on my shell? Nothing. Let's go on. My sides move in rhythmic waves, just off the ground, from front to back, the wake of a ship, wax white water, or a slowly melting flow. I am cold, cold, cold as ice. My blind, white bull's head was a Cretan scarehead. Degenerate, my four horns can't attack. The sides of my mouth are now my hands. They press the earth and suck it hard. But I know my shell is beautiful and high and glazed and shining. I know it well, although I have not seen it. Its curled white lip is of the finest enamel. Inside it is as smooth as silk, and I fill it to perfection. My wide wake shines. Now it is growing dark. I leave a lovely opalescent ribbon. I know this. But oh, I am too big. I feel it. Pity me. If and when I reach the rock, I shall go into a certain crack there for the night. The waterfall below will vibrate through my shell and body all night long. In that steady pulsing, I can rest. All night, I shall be like a sleeping ear. What a wonderful poem, describing life as a snail. Wonderful. Next is Giant Toad. I am too big by far. Pity me. My eyes bulge and hurt. They are my one great beauty, even so. They see too much, above, below. And yet, there is not much to see. The rain has stopped. The mist is gathering on my skin in drops. The drops run down my back, run from the corners of my downturned mouth, run my sides and drip beneath my belly. Perhaps the droplets on my mottled hide are pretty, like dewdrops, silver on a mouldering leaf. They chill me through and through. I feel my colours changing now, my pigments gradually shudder and shift over. Now I shall get beneath that overhanging ledge. Slowly. Hop. Two or three times more, silently. That was too far. I'm standing up. The lichen's grey and rough to my front feet. Get down. Turn facing out. It's safer. Don't breathe until the snail gets by. But we go travelling the same weathers. Swallow the air in mouthfuls of cold mist. Give voice, just once. Oh, how it echoed from the rock. What a profound angelic bell I rang. I live, I breathe by swallowing. Once, some naughty children picked me up, me and two brothers. They set us down again somewhere, and in our mouths they put lit cigarettes. We could not help but smoke them to the end. I thought it was the death of me, but when I was entirely filled with smoke, when my slack mouth was burning and all my tripes were hot and dry, they let us go. But I was sick for days. I have big shoulders like a boxer. They are not muscle, however, and their colour is dark. They are my sacks of poison, the almost unused poison that I bear, my burden and my great responsibility. Big wings of poison, folded on my back. Beware, I am an angel in disguise. My wings are evil, but not deadly. If I will it, the poison could break through, blue-black and dangerous to all. Blue-black fumes would rise upon the air. Beware, you frivolous crab. There we go, that's the toad's perspective. Next is in the waiting room. Ah, okay. In Worcester, Massachusetts, I went with Aunt Consuelo to keep her dentist's appointment and sat and waited for her in the dentist's waiting room. It was winter. It got dark early. The waiting room was full of grown-up people, arctics and overcoats, lamps and magazines. My aunt was inside what seemed like a long time, and while I waited and read the National Geographic, I could read, and carefully studied the photographs. The inside of a volcano, black and full of ashes. Then it was spilling over into rivulets of fire. Osra Martin Johnson, dressed in riding breeches, laced boots and pith helmets. A dead man slung on a pole. Long pig, the caption said. Babies with pointed heads wound round and round with string. Black naked women with necks wound round and round with wire like the necks of light bulbs. Their breaths were horrifying. I read it right straight through. I was too shy to stop. And then I looked at the cover. The yellow margins, the date. Suddenly, from inside, came an oh of pain. Aunt Consuelo's voice, not very loud or long. I wasn't at all surprised. Even then I knew she was a foolish, timid woman. I might have been embarrassed, but wasn't. What took me completely by surprise was that it was me. My voice, in my mouth. Without thinking at all, I was my foolish aunt. We were falling. Falling, our eyes glued to the cover of the National Geographic, February 1918. I said to myself, 3 days and you will be 7 years old. I was saying it to stop the sensation of falling off the round, turning world into cold, blue-black space. But I felt, you are an I. You are an Elizabeth. You are one of them. Why should you be one, too? I scarcely dared to look to see what it was I was. I gave a sidelong glance. I couldn't look any higher at shadowy grey knees, trousers and skirts and boots and different pairs of hands lying under the lamps. I knew that nothing stranger had ever happened, that nothing stranger could ever happen. Why should I be my aunt or me or anyone? What similarities, boots, hands, the family voice I felt in my throat, or even the National Geographic and those awful hanging breaths held us all together or made us all just one? How I didn't know any word for it, how unlikely. How had I come to be here, like them, and overhear a cry of pain that could have got loud and worse, but hadn't? The waiting room was bright and too hot. It was sliding beneath a big black wave, another and another. Then I was back in it. The war was on. Outside, in Worcester, Massachusetts, were night and slush and cold. And it was still the 5th of February, 1918. I like that one. I like that one. Insomnia is next. that's something that's affected me on off all my life, insomnia. The moon in the bureau mirror looks out a million miles, and perhaps with pride at herself, but she never, never smiles. Far and away beyond sleep, or perhaps she's a daytime sleeper. By the universe deserted, she'd tell it to go to hell, and she'd find a body of water or a mirror on which to dwell. Frank Heron would drop it down the well in that earth where death is always right, where the shadows are really the body, where we sit awake all night, where the heavens are shallow as the sea is now deep, and you love me. Next is Invitation to Miss Marianne Moore. From Brooklyn, over the Brooklyn Bridge, on this fine morning, please come flying. In a cloud of fiery pale chemicals, please come flying to the rapid rolling of thousands of small blue drums descending out of the mackerel sky over the grandstand of harbour water. Please come flying. Whistles, pennants and smoke are blowing. The ships are signalling cordially with multitudes of flags rising and falling like birds all over the harbour. Enter two rivers, gracefully bearing countless little pellucid jellies in cut glass epergnes, dragging with silver chains. The flight is safe. The weather is all arranged. The waves are running in verses this fine morning. Please come flying. Come with the pointed toe of each black shoe, trailing a sapphire highlight with a black cape full of butterfly wings and bon mots, with heaven knows how many angels all riding on the broad black brim of your hat. Please come flying. Bearing a musical inaudible abacus, a slight censorious frown and blue ribbons, please come flying. Facts and skyscrapers glint in the tide. Manhattan is all awash with morals this fine morning, so please come flying. Mounting the sky with natural heroism, above the accidents, above the malignant movies, the taxicabs and injustices at large, while horns resounding in your beautiful ears that simultaneously listen to a soft, uninvented music fit for the musk deer. Please come flying. For whom the grim museums will behave like courteous male bowerbirds. For whom the agreeable lions lie in wait on the steps of the public library, eager to rise and follow through the doors up into the reading rooms. Please come flying. We can sit down and weep. We can go shopping or play at a game of constantly being wrong with a priceless set of vocabularies, or we can bravely deplore, but please, please come flying. With dynasties of negative constructions darkening and dying around you, with grammar that suddenly turns and shines like flocks of sandpipers flying, please come flying. Come like a light in the white max sky. Come like a daytime comet with a long, unnebulous train of words from Brooklyn over the Brooklyn Bridge on this fine morning. Please come flying. Share that one in the chat room. Large Bad Picture is next. I don't think I'm going to be able to get through all of these poems. She wrote, I mean, she only wrote 101 poems. She wrote a lot of them. What I mean by that, she only wrote 101, but she wrote a lot in those 101 poems. Filled to the brim. Each one of them. Remembering the Strait of Belle Isle or some northerly harbour of Labrador, before he became a schoolteacher, a great uncle painted a big picture. Receding for miles on either side into a flushed, still sky are overhanging pale blue cliffs hundreds of feet high. Their bases fretted by little arches. The entrances to caves running in along the level of a bay masked by perfect waves. On the middle of that quiet floor sits a fleet of small black ships, square-rigged, sails furled, motionless, their spars like burnt matchsticks. And high above them, over the tall cliffs, semi-translucent ranks, are scribbled hundreds of fine black birds hanging in ends in banks. One can hear their crying. Crying. The only sound there is except for occasional sizzling as a large aquatic animal breathes. In the pink light, the small red sun goes rolling, rolling, round and round and round at the same height in perpetual sunset, comprehensive, consoling, while the ships consider it. Apparently they have reached their destination. It would be hard to say what brought them there. Commerce or contemplation? Next is letter to NY, so it's a letter to New York. For Louise Crane, this one. A poet from memory, Louise Crane. I think. Or am I, no, it's Stephen Crane I'm thinking about here, sorry. In your next letter, I wish you'd say where you were going and what you were doing. How are the plays and after the plays? What are the pleasures you're pursuing? Taking cabs in the middle of the night, driving as if to save your soul, where the road goes round and round the park and the meter glares like a moral owl. And the trees look so queer and green, standing alone in big black caves, and suddenly you're in a different place where everything seems to happen in waves. And most of the jokes you just can't catch, like dirty words rubbed off a slate. And the songs are loud, but somehow dim, and it gets so terribly late. And coming out of the brownstone house to the grey sidewalk, the watered street, one side of the buildings rises with the sun like a glistening field of wheat. Wheat, not oats, dear. I'm afraid if it's wheat, it's none of your sowing. Nevertheless, I'd like to know what you are doing and where you are going. Next is Lines Written in the Fanny Farmer Cookbook. I like this one. This is given to Frank Bidart, apparently. Okay. Okay. You won't become a gourmet cook by studying our Fanny's book. Her thoughts on food and keeping house are scarcely those of Levi Strauss. Nevertheless, you'll find, Frank, dear, the basic elements are here. And if a problem should arise, the souffle fall before your eyes or strange things happen to the rice, you know I love to give advice. Elizabeth, Christmas 1971. P.S. Fanny should not be underrated. She has become sophisticated. She's picked up many gourmet tricks since the edition of 96. Next is Little Exercise. Edwards Wanning. Okay. Think of the storm roaming the sky uneasily like a dog looking for a place to sleep in. Listen to it growling. Think how they must look now. Mangrove keys lying out there unresponsive to the lightning in dark, coarse-fibred families, where occasionally a heron may undo his head, shake up his feathers, make an uncertain comment when the surrounding water shines. Think the blue line of the palm trees all stuck in rows, suddenly reared with full root fish skeleton. It's rained there. The blue line is broken sidewalk with weeds and every cracker needs to be wet, to be freshened. Now the storm goes away again in a series of small, badly lit battle scenes, each in another part of the field. Think of someone sleeping in the bottom of a rowboat tied to a mangrove root or the pile of a bridge. Think of him as uninjured, barely disturbed. And next is Love Lies Sleeping. I think I've read this one before. And it's gorgeous. Earliest morning, switching all the tracks across the sky from cinder star to star, coupling the ends of streets to trains of light. Now draw us into daylight in our beds, and clear away what presses on the brain. Put out the neon shapes that float and swell and glare down the grey avenue between the eyes in pinks and yellows, letters and twitching signs. Hangover moons wane, wane. From the window I see an immense city, carefully revealed, made delicate by overworkmanship, detail upon detail, cornice upon facade, reaching up so languidly into a weak white sky. It seems to waver there. Where it has slowly grown in skies of water glass from fused beads of iron and copper crystals, the little chemical garden in the jar trembles and stands again, pale blue, green and brick. The sparrows hurriedly begin their play. Then, in the west, boom, a cloud of smoke. Boom. And the exploding ball of blossom blooms again. And all the employees who work in a plant where such a sound says danger, or once said death, turn in their sleep and feel the short hairs bristling on backs of necks. The cloud of smoke moves off. A shirt is taken off a thread-like clothesline. Along the street below, the water wagon comes, throwing its hissing snowy fan across peelings and newspapers. The water dries, light dry, dark wet, the pattern of the cool watermelon. I hear the day springs of the morning strike from stony walls and halls and iron beds, scattered or grouped cascades, alarms for the expect. Queer cupids of all persons getting up, whose evening meal they will prepare all day. You will dine well on his heart, on his, and his. So send them about your business affectionately, dragging in the streets their unique loves. Scourge them with roses only. Be light as helium, for always to one, or several. Morning comes whose head has fallen over the edge of his bed, whose face is turned so that the image of the city grows down into his open eyes, inverted and distorted. No, I mean distorted and revealed, if he sees it all. Next is Lullaby for the Cat. Minnow. Go to sleep and dream. Close your great big eyes. Round your bed events prepare the pleasantest surprise. Darling minnow, drop that frown. Just cooperate. Not a kitten shall be drowned in the Marxist state. Joy and love will both be yours. Minnow, don't be glum. Happy days are coming soon. Sleep and let them come. Next is Manners. For a child of 1918, it starts. My grandfather said to me as we sat on the wagon seat, "Be sure to remember to always speak to everyone you meet." We met a stranger on foot. My grandfather's whip tapped his hat. "Good day, sir. Good day. A fine day." And I said it and bowed where I sat. Then we overtook a boy we knew with his big pet crow on his shoulder. "Always offer everyone a ride. Don't forget that when you get older," my grandfather said. So Willie climbed up with us, but the crow gave a caw and flew off. I was worried. How would he know where to go? But he flew a little way at a time, fence post to fence post, ahead. And when Willie whistled, he answered, "A fine bird," my grandfather said. "He's well brought up. See, he answers nicely when he's spoken to. Man or beast, that's good manners. Be sure that you both always do." When automobiles went by, the dust hid the people's faces, but we shouted, "Good day, good day, fine day," at the top of our voices. When we came to Hustler Hill, he said that the mayor was tired, so we all got down and walked, as our good manners required. Next is Manuel Zinio. If I pronounced that correctly. In Brazil, Manuel Zinio. And it starts with Brazil, a friend of the writer is speaking. Half squatter, half tenant, no rent, a sort of inheritance. White, in your 30s now, and supposed to supply me with vegetables, but you don't. Or you won't, or you can't get the idea through your brain. The world's worst gardener since Cain. Titled above me, "Your gardens ravish my eyes." You edge the beds of silver cabbages with red carnations and lettuces mixed with alyssum. And then umbrella ants arrive. Or it rains for a solid week and the whole thing's ruined again and I buy you more pounds of seeds. Imported. Guaranteed. And eventually you bring me a mystic the carrot or a pumpkin bigger than the baby. I watch you through the rain, trotting, light on bare feet, up the steep paths you have made. Your father and grandfather made, all over my property, with your head and back inside a sodden burlap bag. And I feel I can't endure it another minute. Then, indoors, beside the stove, keep on reading a book. You steal my telephone wires, or someone does. You starve your horse and yourself and your dogs and family among endless variety. You eat boiled cabbage stalks. And once I yelled at you so loud to hurry up and fetch me those potatoes, your holy hat flew off. You jumped out of your clogs, leaving three objects arranged in a triangle at your feet, as if you'd been a gardener in a fairy tale all this time, and that the word potatoes had vanished to take up your work of fairy prince somewhere. The strangest things happen to you. Your cows eat a poison grass and drop dead on the spot. Nobody else's does. And then your father dies, a superior old man with a black plush hat and a moustache like a widespread eagled seagull. The family gathers, but you don't think he's dead. I look at him. He's cold. They're burying him today. But you know, I don't think he's dead. I give you money for the funeral and you go and hire a bus for the delighted mourners. So I have to hand over some more and then have to hear you tell me you pray for me every night. And then you come again, sniffing and shivering, hat in hand, with that wistful face like a child's fistful of bluets or white violets, improvident as the dawn. And once more I provide for a shot of penicillin down at the pharmacy, or one more bottle of electrical baby syrup. Or, briskly, you come to settle what we call our accounts, with two old copybooks, one with flowers on the cover, the other with a camel. Immediate confusion. You've left out decimal points. Your columns stagger, honeycombed with zeros. You whisper conspiratorially. The numbers mount to millions. Account books? They are dream books. In the kitchen we dream together how the meek shall inherit the earth, or several acres of mine. With blue sugar bags on their heads, carrying your lunch, your children scuttle by me like little moles above ground, or even crouch behind bushes as if I were out to shoot them. Impossible to make friends, though each will grab at once for an orange or a piece of candy. Twined in wisps of fog, I see you all up there along with Formoso, the donkey who brays like a pump gone dry, then suddenly stops. All just standing, staring off into fog and space. All coming down at night, in silence, except for hoofs, in dim moonlight, the horse or Formoso stumbling after. Between us float a few big, soft, pale blue, sluggish fireflies, the jellyfish of the air. Patch upon patch upon patch, your wife keeps all of you covered. She's gone over and over. Forearmed is forewarned, your pair of bright blue pants with white thread, and these days your limbs are draped in blueprints. You paint, heaven knows why, the outside of the crown and brim of your straw hat. Perhaps to reflect the sun? Or perhaps when you were small, your mother said, Manuel Zinho, one thing, be sure you always paint your straw hat. One was gold for a while, but the gold wore off like plate. One was bright green. Unkindly, I called you chlorophyll kid. My visitors thought it was funny. I apologize here and now. You helpless, foolish man. I love you all I can, I think, or I do. I take off my hat, unpainted and figurative, to you. Again, I promise to try. I'm just looking at the time. Yeah, I've got about 9 minutes. Let's see what else there is. There's quite a lot here. North Haven is next. I think probably time for about 3 or 4 more before I shall start wrapping up. This is North Haven. And it's in memoriam to Robert Lowell. I can make out the rigging of a schooner a mile off. I can count the new cones on the spruce. It is so still, the pale bay wears a milky skin. The sky no clouds except for one long carded horse's tail. The islands haven't shifted since last summer, even if I like to pretend they have. Drifting in a dreamy sort of way, a little north, a little south, or sidewise. And that they're free within the blue frontiers of bay. This month our favourite one is full of flowers. Buttercups, red clover, purple vetch, hackweed still burning, daisies pied, eyebright, the fragrant bedstraws, incandescent stars, and more returned to paint the meadows with delight. The goldfinches are back, or others like them. And the white-throated sparrow's five-note song, pleading and pleading, brings tears to the eyes. Nature repeats herself, or almost does. Repeat, repeat, repeat. Revise, revise, revise. Years ago, you told me it was here, in 1932, you first discovered girls and learned to sail and learned to kiss. You had such fun, you said, that classic summer. Fun. It always seemed to leave you at a loss. You left North Haven, anchored in its rock, afloat in mystic blue. And now, you've left for good. You can't derange or rearrange your poems again, but the sparrows can their song. The words won't change again. Sad friend, you cannot change. And O Breath is next. Beneath that loved and celebrated breast, silent, bored, divinely vain, grieves, maybe lives and lets live, passes bet, but invisibly. And with what clamour, why restrained, I cannot fathom even a ripple. Save a thin flying of nine black hairs, four around, one five the other nipple, flying almost intolerably on your own breath. Equivocal. But what we have in common's bound to be there. Whatever we must own equivalents for. Something that maybe I could bargain with and make a separate peace beneath, within, if never with. And next is one art. Ah, here we go. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the flutter of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster. Places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three beloved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and faster some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them. But it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, a disaster. And I think we have time for one more. And that'll be poem. Mind you, I think poem's too long looking at it. So I might try something else. It's too long. Questions of travel, that's too long, is it? Yep. Rain towards morning. We'll finish with this one. Rain Towards Morning by Elizabeth Bishop. The great light cage has broken up in the air, freeing, I think, about a million birds whose wild ascending shadows will not be back. and all the wires come falling down. No cage, no frightening birds. The rain is brightening now. The face is pale that tried the puzzle of their prison and solved it with an unexpected kiss, whose freckled, unsuspected hands are lit. And that concludes today's Poetry Corner. And that was the study of Elizabeth Bishop. Not sure who it's going to be next week, but I'll be able to let you know midweek. Anyway, folks, we're coming up to the top of the hour now. I'm just going to let you know what's happening on the station for the day. Hawk's Nest, I think there's just going to be music playing after me. But going over to Studio A, coming up at 4 p.m. Eastern will be Mark Snyder with Ohio Exopolitics. Following Mark at 6 p.m. will be Ivy West with Voices on the Wind. Following Ivy at 8 p.m. Eastern will be John Wayne with the Unequivocal Truth DEFCON 1. And rounding off the evening on Studio A at 10 p.m. Eastern will be Rob Davidson with Celebrate Truth. On Studio B, coming up shortly at 4 p.m. Eastern, will be Jay Parker with Matrix Warriors. The next live show on B will be at 7 p.m. Eastern, and that'll be Crypt Rick with the Decompression Hour. And rounding off the evening on B at 10 p.m. will be Bill Grant with Argon. And I'll be back with you tomorrow morning on Studio B at 9 a.m. Eastern with Willow's Weekend World. And I'm probably going to have to change the name of it, really, aren't I? Because I'm on, aren't I? Got plenty going on tomorrow. It's the Sunday morning geek out, and I've got a number of interesting articles to share with you all. So anyway, hope you've all enjoyed the past couple of hours. It's given you some rest and respite, and you all have a great Saturday evening rather, and I will be back with you tomorrow morning on Studio B. Take care, see you then.
Broadcasting live from the peak of Mount Warning, the most easterly point of Australia. Tune in to the Free Manatee Radio Show with your host, Spread Love, every Monday, 6 a.m. EST. On the show each week, we discuss realistic solutions to help you observe rather than take part in the globalist agenda. We will dig into the past to find solutions for the future. We will discuss the wisdom of Ayurveda, the science of life, for techniques for understanding and achieving personal health and longevity. Please join us every Monday on Studio A, 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, the Free Manatee Radio broadcast with your host, Spread Love, on Revolution Radio. freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
What the heck is the truth, Jihad? Hey, I'm Kevin Barrett, host of Truth Jihad Radio. Federal prosecutors, Department of Homeland Security agents, and curious passersby often ask me, just what is this truth jihad thing anyway? Well, everybody knows.